Since when did you start wearing underpants? Hello, my name is Will, and this is Exploding Helicopter, a podcast that's been completely deleted from all law enforcement databases. Today, Mel Gibson is best known as an anti-Semitic, drink-driving wife-beater. But 30 years ago, before he became the man we know and loathe, Mad Mel was the kind of actor people were delighted to see in a light-hearted romantic action comedy. And if you were making such a film, who better to partner with him than the always adorable, kooky blonde, Goldie Hawn? That presumably was the logic behind the film we're reviewing here, 1990's Bird on a Wire. To help me review the film, I'm joined by a man whose track record of toxic behaviour you'd have thought would have made him persona non grata on any respectable podcast. It's Nick Rehack from French Toast Sunday. How are you doing, Nick?
I'm doing great, Will. How are you?
I'm very well, and I'm glad that you can be here. I'm glad that cancel culture hasn't got round to permanently erasing you from our world.
I tell you what, the more and more I hear about things, the more and more I'm like, yeah, they shouldn't go back and listen to this episode of French Toast Sunday. Oh, they shouldn't listen to that episode of the Lambcast.
You're just deleting anything that you can find of yours online, aren't you?
Pretty much. It's going through and it's like, oh, let's hurry up and get rid of this guy, get rid of that guy. Maybe Photoshop it to look like someone else messed it up for me and I'm being attacked or hacked.
Well, I think this is a rock that we really probably shouldn't look under. So I think it's best that we move quickly on. So let's get stuck into Bird in a Wire. But before we do that, let's listen to Trailer Man give us a potted version of the plot.
It happened one night. And after 15 years...
Frank, is that you?
Yeah, it's me, Rick. Let me in, will you?
Marianne Graves discovered an old flame.
What the hell are you doing here?
Me? What the hell are you doing here?
Being shot in the butt.
Had never died.
You get lost in your plane, you're reported missing, you're presumed dead. I attend your memorial service and I cry the tears of a grieving widow.
Muffy.
Until one day, I pull into a gas station... And you're alive with people chasing you. And you asked me to look at your butt?
Rick Jarman is put in witness protection after he helps the FBI bust drug dealer Eugene Sorensen. 15 years later, he is living with a new identity as a gas station attendant when his old flame Marianne stops at the garage and recognizes him blowing his cover. The recently released Sorensen finds out, and both Jarman and Marianne have to flee across country with a vengeful Sorensen in hot pursuit. Bird on a Wire came out in 1990. In the lead roles, we have Mel Gibson and Goldie Hawn. The villains are played by David Carradine and Bill Duke. And there is supporting roles for Stephen Tobolowsky and old-timey Hollywood veteran Jeff Corey. The film was directed by John Badham, who is perhaps best known for War Games, Saturday Night Fever and Short Circuit, although he's best known to Exploding Helicopter fans as the director of the genre classic Blue Thunder. This film has a user rating of 6 on IMDb and a 40% audience rating on Rotten Tomatoes. Those ratings reflect the critical opinion of this film, which was largely negative. However, the film was a big commercial success, grossing $138 million from a budget of $20 million, so a big hit there. So with all of that out of the way, Nick, what did you make of Bird on a Wire?
I really enjoyed it. I feel like this is something I would have seen as like a kid, like maybe a young teen, either like, you know, just like flipping through TV and this is on and your parents say like, oh, this movie's on. And they're like, what's this? You're like, oh, we should watch it. And then you watch it and it's like, it's family fun for them. I shouldn't say family fun. It's not compared to today's kind of like chases and action sequences and things like that. It's tame, but it's still really enjoyable and exciting in some parts. And honestly, I'm surprised I've never seen this before, especially with, and I've said this time and time again, like my grandmother introducing me to like Lethal Weapon and Die Hard and all these other films. You think she would have easily seen something like this and went, oh, this is fun. Nick will get some jokes out of this. But I enjoyed it. Am I going to go out of my way to see it again? Probably not. But if it's on, I'll stop and watch it for a bit for sure.
Okay, well, I think I've got a fairly similar take on the film to yourself. So, I mean, I think this film aspires to nothing more than just being harmless fun, and I think it pretty much succeeds in being harmless fun. That said, It's certainly no classic. I mean, it's pretty bang average in my money. I think other people have done these types of sort of light, frothy entertainments much better with two characters, you know, thrust together and they have to go on some sort of convoluted adventure together. I think, you know, that's been that's a kind of plot device. It's very, very old. It's definitely been done better than this. I think this film kind of relies on the charm of its actors. I think Goldie Hawn and Mel Gibson are pretty good leads. They do as much as they can with the material. And I think this film definitely relies on its pace to keep your interest, because I think if you stop and start engaging intellectually with some of the elements of the plot here, they just don't stand up to any kind of scrutiny. So I think this thing just moves along as fast as it can, gives you lots of Mel Gibson and Goldie Hawn, and it just tries to sort of distract you from really interrogating the plot. And if you don't really think about this film, you can enjoy it mostly. I mean, it's, as you say, I don't think it's a film I'm going to be rushing back to again, but I've watched far worse things in my life.
Absolutely. And I think what helps is you said the guy that directed this also directed War Games. That's a kind of similar premise where you have two characters running from, you know, one side of the country to the other in pursuit. And, you know, they keep that pace up. I think that film has a little bit more story and plot behind it that makes some sense than this movie. But you could definitely see like some parallels between the two.
Yeah, I mean, there's a sort of long tradition of these types of films where you have odd couples thrown together into a harem-scarum adventure. And, you know, whether those films work basically boils down to two things. The chemistry between the two leads and the action adventure and the hijinks they get up to along the way. So, you know, I thought let's have a look at those two elements. Let's maybe just sort of start with the chemistry. I mean, what did you make of chemistry that we get here between Gibson and Goldie?
I think the chemistry was fantastic. It almost felt kind of like how it would have been if Goldie Hawn and Kurt Russell had been starring in this together. Like, it felt like they just knew each other well and well out, and they were able to play off one another. And I felt like some lines might have been like improvised or just made up on the spot, and the other person just kind of rolled along with it, like might have laughed for a second but then pulled it together and kept pushing through the scene. It just felt like this real easy comfort with the two of them. And part of me wants to look through and see if they've done other films together and watch those and see if the same kind of chemistry is there, or if this just happens to be like a lucky one-off. But at no point was I'm like, man, I feel bad for her having to do this scene, or oh man, it's got to suck for him to be in this scene. Like, it just felt natural. It felt genuine. And I think that's what adds to the level of like, I enjoyed this. Like, it's an enjoyable kind of, you know, back and forth, and there's a give and take equally, right? It's not like he's, you know, super into her or mean to her or whatever, or vice versa. She, you know what I mean? It's very much level footing.
Well, it's funny you mentioned Kurt Russell there and thinking that this was something that he could have been in, because apparently he was originally intended to be in this movie, but he was doing something else. And apparently he suggested Mel Gibson to star instead, because they'd both acted together in Tequila Sunrise, which had come out just a couple of years before this was released. So and obviously Goldie Hawn and Kurt Russell sort of made quite a few films together. I can't remember how many they've done together now, but interesting to think what this would have been like with Kurt Russell in the part.
I think it would have been just as fun. It might have been just a touch more serious and not as like kind of goofy.
I think it would have been the other way. I think it would have been lighter with Kurt Russell, because I think Gibson is a bit more serious and a bit more sort of intense. And I think, you know, we've seen Kurt Russell, he's done much more comedy than Mel Gibson ever has.
See, I haven't seen as much Kurt Russell comedy. I've only seen him in more of the, you know, escape from films. Obviously Tombstone. So that's my kind of painted version of who Kurt Russell is, and not some of the lighter hearted stuff like Overboard. Whereas Mel Gibson, I've never really seen him. I mean, yeah, you got films like The Patriot and Ransom and obviously the Mad Max films and everything, but I still tend to see him more in like the light harder side of things, like Lethal Weapon, even though he's playing an insane person and there's all that action. But I don't know. There's just more of a, I guess because he is like certifiable, you could see it in his eyes that he's crazy, that there's more of a like fun, goofy side of thing. You know what I mean? But That's interesting that they would have, that it was originally supposed to be those two.
I mean, I enjoyed the chemistry, like you. I enjoyed the chemistry between the two actors here. I did think some of the early scenes between them were a little bit awkward, and I don't know if that was down to the performances or just down to the fact that the dynamic between them, I just think, was just not very well sort of established. I mean, the plot just kind of throws them together, and then about sort of 15 or 20 minutes later, it, you know, fills in the backstory between them. And I wonder if it's that really sort of plays into why I kind of found those, some of those early scenes a little bit clunky between them. But certainly kind of once the film gets into its groove, and once either they warm up or once I warm up, I definitely enjoyed the relationship that they had between them. I mean, just on Goldie Hawn's character, I was kind of interested what you made of this, because I felt like the film didn't quite have what they wanted from Goldie Hawn's character quite nailed down, because we see these scenes where she's this high-powered lawyer and she's, you know, doing these, you know, big, seems to be involved in these big international deals. But then in other moments, she's portrayed in sort of classic Goldie Hawn style, as we've seen many times before in her career, as, you know, somebody who's a bit of a ditz. And so, for me, didn't seem to really know whether they wanted her character to be, yeah, a bit of a sort of airhead, or whether she was actually somebody who, you know, who was quite sharp and on the ball. And, you know, I think that kind of hurts the film a little bit at different moments, because you're certainly at the beginning, you're like, okay, what am I supposed to think of this character?
I wholeheartedly agree. Because, like you said, she's this powerful lawyer. She's kind of running the show. Even in the beginning, you know what I mean, when she sits down at the restaurant and she's ordering food and she keeps kind of changing her mind, but she's keeping the power there, right? And even when she gets up, she's just making a phone call, right? She's not really making any kind of extra special move. She's just keeping those people in their place. You could chalk it up to maybe the directors or writers getting away with it by saying, oh, well, their relationship's clunky at first because she hasn't seen him in so long and he hasn't seen her, and they're just trying to reestablishing things. Okay, yeah, maybe. But like you said, when it comes to the back and forth and flip-flop, it's not like she's bouncing back and forth between her old life and her new life. Her new life is who she is now. This is that person. Her old life is just memory. So it's not like she's going to go reverting back to that old state or trying to recapture some kind of magic. No, like, she is this powerful lawyer person. Keep her as this person. Don't – or like how she becomes later on when they're on the farm, jealous kind of this horse doctor, right? I don't know what the veterinarian.
Yeah.
she's
I like jealous. I like horse doctor better, but, you know, for everyone listening, she's a vet.
She's jealous of this veterinarian in a way, right? And she gets kind of snipey, and then it becomes like this back and forth kind of catty thing. And it's like, I feel like you're above that. Like, I feel like you're a much better person, but now you're being – like, you're devolving in this role. And, yeah, some things make sense. Some things it doesn't. And I wholeheartedly agree with you.
Well, you've brought up the scene with the vet that takes place in this film. So, you know, Mel Gibson's on the run and washes up at a place that he used to work. And he used to have a sort of romantic relationship with the vet who runs this farmyard or kind of countryside practice. In that particular sequence, there was a kind of a little scene that I just thought really dated this film back to 1990. And basically, Mel Gibson has been shot in the buttocks and he's at the vet's. He has to pull down his trousers so the vet can remove the bullet from his backside. So we get a nice little shot that's been inserted, I guess, for the ladies of Mel Gibson's buttocks. You know, I'm sure that was the reason why it was put in there. But Mel Gibson's buttocks, they were very hairy. And I'm kind of thinking, if this film was made today, he would have been dispatched down to the nearest salon for an immediate wax. There is no way, I think, you know, a heartthrob's buttocks would be put in a film with that much hair on today.
It really does. I mean, his buttocks gave Robin Williams' arms a run for their money. And I mean, he's still no beard. That's the craziest part. You don't see him with a beard in this film, rarely ever. He had one in Fat Man where he was, you know, portraying Santa Claus. But think of another film where he has had like a serious beard. It's the world has been deprived for so long of what I'm sure is an awesome beard. And instead, the hair is just coming out everywhere else. His arms, when they're in the bed later, nothing on his arm, like from the elbow up to the chest area, nothing. But his forearms, hairy. Hairy. The rest of them, hairy. But for some reason, wherever the t-shirt is, no hair. And it doesn't make sense to me. Long hair. He's got his hair in a ponytail or in a bun or just in the back in general for, I'm fairly certain, all of the film.
Yeah.
But no beard. And you'd think with FBI, I changed around everything, change up your look, grow a beard, do just a mustache. Like, say he had a mustache
in the flashback, didn't we? We see him with a stash.
Occasionally pull one out, do a goatee, do something. Like, don't just hair it up everywhere else, man.
But another thing I was thinking about this film, I don't know what, you know, maybe I was overthinking the kind of relationship between Gibson and Goldie Hawn here. And I kind of, you know, we learn that Goldie Hawn has been holding a bit of a candle for Mel Gibson, because basically he disappeared like 15 years ago because he was hauled into the FBI's witness protection program. So they were about to get married. He disappears. She, you know, the FBI fake his death. So, you know, she's grieving for him, but she's, apparently we learn later, she's been burning this candle for Mel Gibson. She's got some of his old photographs in her, you know, in her wallet or in her purse. And I felt actually would have been better actually if it was Mel Gibson who'd been burning the candle for Goldie Hawn. And he'd basically had to decide, well, you know, I've got to go in, you know, that's what he's giving up by going into the witness protection program, that, you know, I've got to do this. I'd be a danger to Goldie Hawn if I was in her life. So, you know, so he's kind of sacrificing himself. And I kind of felt that if they'd sort of flipped it that round, it would have made for a more interesting dynamic between the two characters.
Well, they do kind of touch on that, but then it's too little too late, right? When he's laying in bed and they're like, I haven't had a girlfriend in 5 years. I mean, obviously it's alluding more to like sex stuff than anything else, but there's just a hint of vulnerability. He's like, I haven't had a girlfriend in 5 years. I don't think it'd be fair to them. That would be a perfect opportunity for them to open up and have like a more meaningful conversation about something. And it might add a little bit more weight and then retroactively add a little something to the rest of the film. But it just doesn't happen. That just makes an excuse to, you know, talk about his Willy, if you will. And then
Mr. Wiggly, you know, as Mel Gibson refers to it in the film. which plays a big part in the ending of this film.
It sure does.
But that scene that you're just talking about,
it's a real banner moment, if you will.
Exactly. Yeah. We won't say any more than that, lest we spoil the kind of the film's sort of final moments. But that scene that you were just talking about, that's probably one of my favourite scenes in the film. Actually, that scene in the motel, because where they're just lying in bed talking and they're kind of going over some of this old ground. Because it just felt like, you know, we don't really get that much of that type of content in the rest of the film. It's all just sort of driven by the chases and the adventure and the hijinks, and here's actually a bit of a human moment between these two characters, and it just really stands out you know, within the film, and it's definitely one of the better moments, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I think just because we do have a time to stop and breathe, and then it just feels like two people talking. It almost, to an extent, feels like they just put the cameras on and they said, well, let's just see what happens. Because it feels like two people reconnecting, teasing each other about, oh, you're with, who's this guy that you're with now? You know what I mean? Like, why do you care? Oh, I don't care, but I just, you know, I'm curious. I want to know. Like, just like a fun back and forth. And, you know, we do miss out on that because they're having to constantly, like, split up and then get back together or run away from here, run away from there. It's like, you go that way, I'll go this way, meet in the middle, like, it's just kind of a nonstop, but then they get to sit down and then it really is just kind of nice. But it makes sense that it's not till the end, but I think it kind of just, it leaves the level of heft, if you will, like towards the end. But by then it's like, okay, just get to the, let's get to the big climax. Let's see what happens next. They're not so much focused on anything else.
Well, we've had a little chat about the chemistry between the actors. I mean, what did you make of the action, the kind of the adventure and the hijinks that that take place along the way as these two characters try to stay alive?
I think it was a lot of fun. They tackled a bit of everything. They did car chases. They did motorcycle chases. They did maybe not high wire, but like just high platform type stuff between buildings, and then for some bizarre reason, there's a flashback where they're at a carnival of some sort, and he's just walking on top of a Ferris wheel. Like, okay, I guess so. If that's really what you want to do. Obviously, there's planes and things, and then we get into the big finale, like a big a different kind of shootout, which I thought was neat. But overall, it checks off all the boxes. I don't think there's any type of action sequence that they didn't get into. I really nothing underwater, so that kind of outside of underwater stuff.
Didn't do anything on a train.
Get into. Well, technically, they were on train tracks.
Yeah, no, I take it back. No, you're right. There is a bit of train action in this film, so.
Yeah.
No, if they get planes, trains, and automobiles, you get your, certainly get your full value for money on that front. I mean, I thought I quite liked the car chase that we get in here. So, Goldie Hawn is driving, and Mel Gibson's kind of just sort of jumped in. He's the wrong way up, and he's upside down, like pushing the pedals with his hands whilst sort of Goldie Hawn drives the car. And I thought that was, quite a nice little neat idea. Don't think I've seen that in another film. I enjoyed that particular moment in the movie.
Absolutely, because it's different too. Sometimes it's the other way around where it's like, what do we do? Hit this pedal, hit that. And they're like trying to guide them while one's shooting, right? While one's capable of doing something. But this time around, it's like, I'm stuck. Here we go. Let's just make this work. I will say this, though. He should not be able to walk the rest of the film. The way his legs hit that truck. Oh, my God.
We should probably talk about, we should definitely talk about the big finale of this movie, which takes place at a zoo. And, I mean, there's very little logic within the film as to why this finale takes place at the zoo. It's presumably somebody just wanted to have a big finale at a zoo, so the logic for it is just crowbarred into the movie. Everyone winds up in this zoo in this kind of, I don't know, fake like African sort of auditorium, which pools filled with alligators. There's piranhas in a pond. There are all these lions and tigers and monkeys just all moving around within this one big environment, which it doesn't look like any zoo that I've ever seen. Anyway, we then have a bit of a shootout, some swinging about within this environment between all of the characters. What did you make of the big finale? Because clearly a lot of time, a lot of money, they obviously must have built a massive set on a sound stage in order to put this scene together. What did you make of the big finale of this film?
That's easily where a quarter of the film's budget went. Like, you can't tell me it didn't go there. What I found interesting was you walk in, and when I hear zoo, I think of animals, particularly animals on land. The first thing we're greeted with is a bottlenose dolphin. And then we're greeted by like a fish, and there's all these just more aquatic based animals. And I'm like, okay, is this a zoo? Is it aquarium? Is it a combination? But then, like you said, they kind of hunker in on this enclosure that's focused primarily on, lions and monkeys and things like that, and tigers. Oh my. And, I thought it was weird, but cool at the same time. I've been to different aquariums and zoos where they kind of try to put you in the particular place, and to kind of be in a savanna like that, or just try to recreate that, is kind of neat. But I feel, looking at this, I'm just like, you could have done this at like a I don't know, like at a theme park, like at a Orlando Studios or a Disney World, where you have these stunt extravaganza shows, and had something there. It's really what it felt like after a while. And then they kept like running around and missing each other. And I'm like, hold on, wouldn't you have like a direct path, and you would know, I follow the trail this way to get from the beginning to the end. You wouldn't just circle around and get all confused and stuff. The setting didn't make sense, but I enjoyed what happened within the setting. Like, I was so confused that I was missing out on like other stuff going on. And then I do like the whole, it just completely goes awry. Like, nothing they want to accomplish goes the way they want to accomplish. She doesn't, hit the lights when she wants to. He doesn't get the shots off that he wants to. Like, none of it works, but it in a way like it still works, like it ends up happening for him. And you think they would absolutely have the upper hand because you worked there before, but it felt like he was just kind of stumbling around the whole time, like kind of like, oh, I hope this works, or oh, you know, I hope this. But it was something.
Well, it's certainly something I have never seen before in a film. So I think if you know, I think in terms of making some sort of zoo setting into some sort of, you know, crazy menagerie of animals and chaos and, you know, all hell breaking loose within it, I think what you get here is probably about as good as an entertaining as it's going to get. You do get to see some sort of, you know, in a film that's kind of meant to be quite lighthearted, I mean, you do get to see, you know, somebody eaten by the piranhas, somebody else gets, you know, killed by a lion. There's some fairly sort of, I mean, you don't see much that's there that's gruesome, but, you know, there's some sort of nasty violence at the end of this film that, I don't know if it wholly fits with kind of the tone, I guess, this film's really aiming for.
Some nasty violence? It's horrific. Horrific.
You've seen worse, Nick.
Eat alive by barracudas. Electrocuted. Everybody else so far has been like, oh, my leg hurts. Oh, I got hit in the face. Oh, you know, I fell in some cement. This is very different. The only thing that's worse is probably at the very beginning when they find him at the car garage. Yeah. And the man and wife that lives above it, his wife's probably dead from an explosion. But outside of that, everybody else is fine. Instead, you just get these horrific deaths. Yeah, you don't see it. They're highly alluded to. But still, it's like, oh, my God. Wait a second. Was this still the same movie? Did something change? Because this is getting horrible all of a sudden.
Okay, we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to be looking at the exploding helicopter action.
Hello everybody, my name is DaVern, and I am the host of the Cinema Recall Podcast, which you can find at thatmomentin.com. On each episode, myself, along with a great guest, we will discuss in detail an iconic scene from a classic movie. So come check us out. We are available on Podomatic, on Stitcher, and most other places you can find podcasts. We are also on Facebook, just type in Cinema Recall. And we're also on Twitter at @cinema_recall. We hope you enjoy the show, and thank you for listening.
We're back, and now we're looking at the exploding helicopter action. This occurs when the villains once again catch up with Mel Gibson and Goldie Hawn. This time, the baddies are inexplicably in a helicopter, logic by this time having long since checked out of the motel. Gibson and Goldie jump into a small plane that's conveniently parked nearby for plot reasons. There's an aerial chase between the two aircraft. With no weapons to use, Mad Mel is forced to take drastic measures to end the pursuit. After managing to get above the chopper, he drops the plane down so that its underside crunches into the rotor blades of the helicopter. The wounded whirlybird veers off, plummets into the ground, where it crashes and then explodes. Nick, what did you make of the exploding helicopter action?
This was a lot of fun. I've never seen a scene like this with a helicopter. I don't know. I was excited. I was excited, then disappointed, and then super excited again. It was this weird sandwich of emotions that I just munched down on and ate repeatedly. I ate it repeatedly because of – I kept rewinding and rewatching it. I'm like, how are we doing this? And they're not both being taken out right now. Like, it's just the helicopter that's going down here. But I dug it. This might be one of my favorite exploding helicopters of recent memory.
Well, I enjoyed the sandwich as much as you did, Nick, because we haven't seen it anywhere else at all. And, you know, when these two aircraft are, you know, involved in this chase, you don't know how that's going to play out, because the villains have got their gun, but Mel Gibson and Goldie Hawn have got no weapons whatsoever. So you don't know how they're going to get out of it. So, you're thinking, okay, maybe it's going to be some sort of trick flying. They're kind of, you know, going to weave in and out of, I don't know, a bridge or something. And, you know, the helicopter pilot will cock up and, you know, crash into the structure of the bridge or something like that. I certainly wasn't expecting what we get here, which is, you know, I mean, it's almost like a wrestler move when they sort of, you know, they do a big they do a big splashdown on their on their
opponent. He's going up on the top turnbuckle.
And so I mean, get to see something completely unique, something we've never seen before, and and then the the actual kind of I guess the mechanics of the explosion are very good. They clearly splashed a lot of petrol and gasoline around, so you get a big fireball from all this sort of burning wreckage. So I mean, I think this particular scene, this particular sequence, is the absolute high point of this movie. You know, not just because it's got an exploding helicopter, because it is actually also giving us something, you know, in terms of an action scene, something that's completely unique.
Absolutely. And I tell you what, I'm glad you brought up the explosion and the excess gas. There are a lot of explosions in this movie that go very much over the top. When they blow up the garage in the beginning of the film, that lights up and blows up several times. When they're on their motorcycle, when they go to get to the motorcycle right before having to get in the plane, that blows up in an absurd manner. It is so absurd. So then when the helicopter hits, it explodes, and then there's like a second round that comes through, and it's even bigger. And I'm like, what were they storing on this helicopter? It's like, is there gas in every possible chamber? Because it is so much. And then I think the film even pokes a little bit of fun at itself, because as they're getting out of the plane, he says, like, hurry up, it might blow up.
Everything else up to this point has. So, I mean, it's a well-founded fear that Mel Gibson's got at this moment, for sure. But, I mean, the only thing, having said it is unique, the only thing that does come close to what we see here is in the film Stealth with Jamie Foxx and I think it's Jessica Biel. Jessica Biel, where we see the kind of the titular plane, which is this, which is kind of this automated plane that's got an artificial intelligence in it, kind of into a helicopter right at the end of that movie. That's the only sort of similar scene, but that's fairly, it's kind of just sort of suicide. It's not the kind of WWF move that we get from Mel Gibson here, so
it still works and it's still fun.
Okay, well, I think that just about wraps things up for this show. Nick, thanks for joining me once again. Do you want to pimp yourself out in the manner that our listeners have become so accustomed to?
I sure do. FrenchToastSunday.com is where I'm from and where I tend to hide from time to time. I'm actually back on Twitter, at The Rehack, T-H-E-R-E-H-A-K. I don't know why I'm back. It's just a lot of retweets and pictures of my cat uninterested in what I'm watching. Recently he was on an episode of the Deep Blue Sea podcast. They're starting to watch Deep Blue Sea 2, so I'm going to be on the introductory episode of that. Keep an ear out for it. Movies and Tea podcast, they're doing a David Lynch I guess retrospective. They're looking to take a look at all of his films. I'm on the episode where we discuss Zodiac, which is my favorite David Fincher film, so give those a listen.
As always, don't forget to check out the Exploding Helicopter website. We've got some new reviews up on the site for your delectation. If you can do something to guess a new listener, I'd be very grateful. We'll be back soon. But until then, keep watching the skies for those exploding helicopters.
This podcast is a proud member of the LAM Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
So come on, tell me about this boyfriend of yours. What's he like in the sack? Can he throw the leg? Huh? Marianne?
I'm not discussing sex with you tonight.
You know, I haven't had a girlfriend in 5 years.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, Mr. Wiggly's been on bread and water for 5 long years.
Okay. Is that the truth?
Yeah, I didn't think it would be fair.
You're cold?
Huh? Oh, not really.
Feels familiar, doesn't it?
Thought you said you didn't remember.
I feel kind of selfish under here.
Oh, you are very selfish, and not just under there.
Oh, well, too bad you said that.
Why?
Well, I was actually beginning to get turned on.
Oh, too bad for you. I wasn't.
Oh, you weren't?
No.
Fine. I'm gonna be out here anyway.